And we move to the fourth case this morning, U.S. versus People.
Good morning, members of the court. My name is Glenn Reynolds. I represent the appellants in this case. Two men, Marshall Pecor and Conrad Weniger, who were officials of the Menominee Tribe. We are requesting the court to reverse the lower court's decision, finding no substantial basis for bringing this case that ultimately resulted in a judgment in their favor. This case presents some very important legal principles with respect to how the Equal Access to Justice Act works. I believe this is the archetypal example of why Congress enacted that act. We had two good men working as employees for an Indian tribe who, with a dozen other people, supervised work in the Menominee Forest and provided information to the government and did the work. And the government, after almost a decade of investigation, decided to sue the tribe for a False Claims Act case. This has never been done in the United States. So the tribe was dismissed by Judge Griesbach. But the two officials that were working for the tribe, that carried out the tribe's wishes, that in conjunction with all the history of the tribal efforts to protect the forest and preserve it and do fire prevention their way, were suddenly singled out as the only two individuals who were sued in this case. They bore their own legal costs. And what this court has said in jurisprudence of the Seventh Circuit is that if the government loses a case, that the individuals who won shall be reimbursed for their costs unless, and the government has the burden of proof on this, they had good facts. And that means that there was a lie. Judge Griesbach didn't think a lie was necessary, but this court has said that a false claim must be false. It must be a lie. Two, that they had a good basis in law to sue two tribal officials acting in their official capacity on behalf of an Indian tribe when the tribe was dismissed. And third, that there had to be a connection, a good connection between not what the allegations were, but what the proof was at trial and how that proof related to the law. The government has the burden to prove all three of those things. And my contention here, and we've given you extensive briefing and a large appendix to look at the proof that we brought in, I don't think the government has established any of those things. First, with respect to the lie, there was an allegation of a lie, members of the court. There was an allegation that from one man, in the middle of an imbroglio, a tribal dispute about how the forest should be managed, a centuries-old debate between the federal government and the Menominee, he goes out without knowing what the standards are for this contract, having in his own mind a sense of what fuel break should be that has never been done in the Midwest, that is not necessary for the Menominee, and that is not required by them. The Menominee have been taking care of this forest for a long time, and they don't have the same ideas that the federal government does. So when they applied for grant funding, they had their own ideas for how to use that money as wisely as possible. They weren't planning to make 30-foot swaths through the forest. So when David Congress went out and he didn't see 30-foot swaths, he said, "No work done." No work done. Archetypal fraud case, just like the doctor who bills for Medicare patients he's never seen. That's a lie. But as this case progressed, and these two men asked me to represent them, we began to look at not the 250,000 pieces of paper that the government collected by subpoenas in this 10-year case. We went out into the forest. We, after 6 years, the government waited until the last minute to bring this case, but even after 6 years, we were able to see extensive cutting. We hired a forensic forester to go out, and he found thousands of stump sprouts per mile. We found evidence of grading. We had photographs showing that the 10 culverts that the government said were never there were there. And here is the photographic evidence. We had worker testimony, individuals who did the work, come into court. They were never interviewed by the government. The first time the government spoke to them was when they testified on the stand. And they established, without any question, and this forensic evidence established without any question, that substantial amounts of work were done. And these 250,000 pieces of paper that the government submitted had in them all the information to show that in this expense billing that the tribe had with the government. Remember, this is not a contractor doing work for the government, as we're seeing in Iraq, where the government is getting ripped off. This is a tribe that gets funding for the government in the exercise of its trust responsibility. And so the beneficiary of the work is the tribe, not the government.
And going back, what is it? You say this is a 10-year situation when, I don't know, not you necessarily, apparently you went out in the woods too, but how much after the original work was done was this inspection? How long after?
The government's inspection was immediate, Your Honor. So the government went out, one person went out, and this is after, by the way, a year of delay in these invoices being paid.
What was that guy's name?
His name was David Congress.
Okay.
He was, in my view, this is a very interesting explanation of how one person within an agency can get the agency rolling on a process that can't stop. And he used one word, Judge, fraud. And that just creates and generates a whole chameleon-like effect within the federal government. So with that fraud allegation, without ever going back and looking to check to see his work, to make sure that he knew what he's talking about, and we have put in evidence, all his memos, advocating criminal investigation, advocating fraud, waste, and abuse on infinitum. He wrote memos to keep this thing going. The government never went back and looked at that work. They had the OIG subpoena 250,000 pieces of paper. And just imagine the time it took the government to look at that for a few thousand dollars of invoices. And in the end, they found one discrepancy on one invoice where one person had miscoded his time cards. All of this could have been cleared up with a dialogue between the federal government and the tribe. If Mr. Congress had said, look, I don't know that, I'm not comfortable with how you're billing this, let's go out and take a look at it, they would have seen that the work was done. But Mr. Congress, the government, unfortunately, and this was a big disappointment for me, for somebody who's practiced law in federal court for 30-some years, when we produced evidence with forensic evidence, thumb sprouts, when we showed photographs of the culverts, when we produced the worker testimony, the government's response was to try to keep it out, not to evaluate it, not to look at it, but to try to exclude it from evidence. And Judge Griesbach almost granted that request. In this appendix are two letters I have never written, one to the U.S. attorney saying, look, come with me to the forest, you'll see that the work is done, and the other to Judge Griesbach pleading with him to allow us to produce this evidence so that these two good men wouldn't be ruined. This is a quasi-criminal offense.
And this is almost, or lots of years after the work was done, right?
That's right, which made it...
I'm just looking at it from a standpoint is what, you have to kind of dig down to find stumps and things just to show that something was done 7 or 8 years ago.
Well, that's right, because the allegation, there was no work done, and Mr. Congress was going to take the stand and said, I saw no evidence of work whatsoever.
Well, one who lives in the woods... It grows in a hurry.
It does grow in a hurry, but what we did was, what we were able to do, and this wasn't easy, this took a long time, we were able to find where the wood was cut, and we were able to find stump sprouts which showed, as we cut them, the number of rings to go back to when these men did the work. So we had that as physical evidence to corroborate the worker testimony, corroborate the records that were in the government's hands, to show that Menominee actually incurred $300,000 of actual expenses for work that they only billed the government for $65,000. And there was an agreement. You know, there was in the brief is this important agreement that was reached after a year of impasse, where David Congress said, I'd like to see you, and this is the appendix, a memorial of it, I'd like to see you get reimbursed for your expenses. I'll recommend payment if you pay $65,000, if it's reduced to $65,000, no mention of the word fraud, no dialogue. And as soon as he just said, I want just one thing, I want Marshall Pecor and Conrad Weininger to sign a certification to say that they have a good reason to believe that this work was done. And they did, because they had been working on this whole thing for years, and we have photographic evidence of it. The first thing he does is he goes into the woods, and he alleges that they're trying now to bill for actual expenses instead of unit miles, which of course is how all the witnesses testified, is how this work has always been billed to the government. And that just started.
The unit miles? That was always the routine?
No, it wasn't the routine. It was actually, and you know, when Judge Griesbach says that, he basically says that the reason for this case was because of MTE's confusing billing practices. And they were confusing. But it was, if one half doesn't see what the other is doing, then it's impossible to understand that what Menominee was trying to do in this new program was trying to capture its expenses by basically saying, you know, we're going to work on this 19-mile stretch and that 19-mile stretch, and we're going to bill the government for miles of treated road as a way of determining whether the expenses are reflected in that. And as it turned out, they were losing their shirts, as is evidenced by the fact that they incurred $300,000 of expenses for a bill that the government was only responsible for, and never paid, by the way, of 65. And so in the appendix is a memo to the BIA, Sean Hart, saying basically that, look, we're, you know, here are the billing options. We can do fixed costs, we can do mile, we can do whatever. And that resulted in Congress saying, we're going to pay you the $65,000, just sign on the dotted line.
We have a district court opinion, and it goes through, obviously he heard all of this, and then he thought it was substantially justified.
I understand. And that
we've got that to go with, and we're looking at it, you know, you make an argument, I'm sure he heard all of this, and now we've got to review it under some kind of a standard here. So
I understand, and I realize that this is a very difficult burden for me because it's an abuse of discretion standard, but what I'm asking the court to do is take a look at the standards that Judge Griesbach applied. He did not require that the government show an evidence of lie. I would like to hear Ms. Warwick tell you not what was alleged, that was a lie, but what was proven at trial. What the government basically said is, well, okay, they were doing work, but they did the wrong kind of work. That's a contract claim.
Counsel, is that 3 minutes into your rebuttal?
That's 3 minutes left in
the total argument. All right. I'm going to ask the court to review these facts very carefully, but, you know, Judge Griesbach, I think, erred as a matter of law with respect to allowing an Indian tribe's officials to be sued when the tribe itself can't be sued, and that is against all the jurisprudence on this subject. It's quoted. The United States Supreme Court says you can't use a pleading device to get around sovereign immunity. You can't sue the tribe and lose the tribe, and then with individuals in their official capacities working for the tribe basically sue the tribe in that way. That's not an appropriate way to do it. So not only was there not a lie, but there wasn't a sound legal basis to sue these two men in lieu of the tribe when the tribe was dismissed. This is the only reported case where tribal officials acting in their official capacities were sued under a False Claims Act. This is the only reported case. But the other piece is that there was no connection between what was proven in trial, which turned into a standards question, that it wasn't the right work done, to a false claims case. It was a contract case. That was it. And that's not false claims. That's the law in this court. I'd reserve my remaining 2 minutes if I could. Most of the other questions. Thank you.
Ms. Warwick?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here on appeal to represent the United States. I was not trial counsel, however, I did the briefing on the motion for the EJIA fees and any subsequent briefing in this case. There are two issues before this court. I will spend most of my time addressing the first issue, and that is, did the district court abuse its discretion when it denied the defendant's joint motion for attorney's fees under EJIA? The second issue that I don't know if I'll have time for is, did the court abuse its discretion when it denied defendant's motion for sanctions, also seeking attorney's fees, under Rule 37? The answer to both issues I submit to the court is that the court did not abuse its discretion. The first thing that counsel posits in his brief was that the court misunderstood the allocation of burden of proof and apparently argues that it was applied, therefore, incorrectly. If close reading of the district court's decision and order on this motion is that the court clearly understood that the government maintained the burden of proof to show that it was substantially justified and that that burden remained with the government as the court took each of the defendant's arguments as they were presented to him separately. The decision is replete with references to how the district court should conduct its analysis. The court understood that its determination would need to be done by considering the case as a whole and not by a line-by-line analysis of the record. In fact, the court termed it as a gestalt approach. The district court, as I mentioned, structured its decision, therefore, by saying at the outset, while I'm mindful that the government has the allocation, has the burden of persuasion on this issue, I will address each of the defendant's arguments as to why the government is not substantially justified. And therefore, what the court did is took a time to go through each of the defendant's arguments against substantial justification. Now, the court did one more thing. And the defendant found fault with this also, and that was the court relied, and I hope I'm not mispronouncing this case, Thuvenot is the way I'm going to go with it. It's T-H-O-U-V-E-N-O-T. And found that case held in part that there's a presumption that a government case strong enough to survive both a motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment is substantially justified. In that portion of the Thuvenot case, the court was troubled because what the district court in that case had done was rested its holding that the government was not substantially justified pretty much on the jury verdict coming back against the government. And the court did no analysis that preceding that verdict, it had, the government, withstood motions to dismiss its case and for summary judgment. This district court looked to that case and saw the following in its record. In the instant case, the government had survived a motion to dismiss by all the parties to the case. Counsel is correct. MTE was found to be a tribal entity and was dismissed from the case. But surviving that motion, the case went forward against defendants Pecor and Wanniger. Further, the government had survived a motion for summary judgment. Now, in turn, the government lost its motion for summary judgment, thus proceeding to trial. In addition to those motions, there was a motion for dismissal at the close of the government's case at trial and dialogue before the court about that issue. Again, the court found that there was enough evidence in the record at the trial for this matter to proceed to a jury that he could not decide the case at that point. Finally, the court reserved the motion to direct a verdict in favor of the defendants at the close of the entire trial. The government survived that motion. The court held it in abeyance and allowed that to go to the jury. The district court conducted a thorough analysis of the government's litigation position. There is no reason not to give this court's opinion considerable deference. As was noted in Pierce v. Underwood, the district court who lived and breathed as counsel noted a very long, very contentious case had motions in front of it, argument in front of it, a trial in front of it, could weigh the evidence as it's supposed to during a trial. And with that kind of that gestalt approach, knowing the full purview of the case, the court painstakingly went through each of those particular issues. Now, there were a number of issues that counsel reasserts on appeal, but one new one that the district court did not hear on the EJIA petition, and that was that the government was not justified in law of continuing its suit under the False Claims Act for defendants Pecor and Wanniger. But that was not a part of their EJIA motion. That was a part of the motion to dismiss and never came through again on the appeal for EJIA. So the government noted in a footnote that particular argument is waived. It was not a part of what the defendants put forth to the district court to allow it to analyze what it had done on a legal basis with that particular issue. What did go forward and what the district court did analyze was the government-to-government policy argument, the argument that the government failed to follow its own regulations, And the district court found that, in fact, those regulations did not apply in this particular instance, that their argument that there was an insufficient basis to assert that the invoices contained a false claim. The court posited, again, that, yes, there were clearly differences between what the government understood the billing methodology to be and the theory that Pecor and Wanniger posited as to what the billing theory was. Regardless of the billing theory, the court said, the point was the work done, and was it done sufficient under the agreement with the hazardous fuel reduction program?
Well, even if the argument's waived, I gather since you're here today, you feel that you can proceed against Pecor and Wanniger.
Yes, I do. There was also, and counsel raised this, the failure to investigate. I won't spend much time on each of these, but let me just say on that particular one. As I reviewed the record in this case, this seemed to be a pretty hotly contested issue. And I guess what I would just like the court to understand is the timing of when this occurred. It was at the close, discovery was done. This was on the eve of trial. And what I see in the record is that there's a motion to the court from the defendants to please accept our expert testimony, please accept our videotapes, please accept our pictures. We're way past discovery, but this will provide exoneration of our clients. The government vehemently opposed that because of the rules. Because the rules say when discovery is done, you may motion to reopen discovery because then we need to continue the process of discovery and give us a chance to depose an expert with enough time to prepare. And give us a chance, if we want, to go out to the forest and re-examine and do the things that we need to do when we're in discovery. But we're not in discovery. We're in trial preparation. So that was the basis for the government opposition to that particular request by the defendants. In the end, the judge let it in. And he makes quite a statement where he explains why he let it in his decision on the EJIA fee, was he felt that the defendants should be entitled to a full record as possible. I believe he gave the government some limited time, I guess I'll call it, to engage in limited discovery to try to get ready, and the case went forward. So whether it can be characterized as the government wanting to suppress the truth or the government wanting to have the civil rules of evidence followed, I guess it would depend on which side of the ball you fall.
On whose constitutional ox is being gored? So go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Depends on whose constitutional ox is being gored.
Yes, that is true. Thank you, Your Honor. And then the last issue that I'll address is the contract dispute versus not a false claim. The court, again, addresses that. He does note, that is, the district court notes, that just because some aspects of the case resemble an action for breach of contract does not take this case out of the realm of the False Claims Act. The government's theory for the case all along was that under an agreement with the tribal entity, there was work to be done under the proposal. Invoices were submitted with supporting documentation that caused the government to pay money that it shouldn't have paid. As to the sanction request under Rule 37, the court addresses the two categories of admissions that were posited by the defense as not being properly responded to and therefore warranting sanction. It had to do with work performed pursuant to the applicable proposals done by the MTE, and the other one was whether the work was substantially performed. And the district court again found that if the government would have admitted, it would have conceded its case. And at that time, which again was in the course of discovery, the position that the government took was, we don't know yet. We're seeing what your evidence shows us. We're seeing as we go through this case and we have our interrogatories and we have our time for discovery with you, including depositions, what that results in. And the court also took one other side note of that, and that was that the defendants could not show that those issues of those particular matters were proved at trial. And were proved true at trial, that the jury could have instead concluded that the government failed to show that the defendants had sufficient knowledge.
What kind of money was involved in this? What was the government trying to recover?
I believe at the outset of the case, it was much more money, and I know this is going to sound fuzzy, it was a lot more money when the tribal entity was a part of the case, and it did go reduced significantly when it was solely against Mr. Pecor and Mr. Waniger. I believe it was in the tens of thousands of dollars.
Well, was it, there were more people involved in the original claim?
I think in the original claim there were further claims that it would allow the government to recover for separate violations of the False Claims Act, and therefore the penalties would have accrued against those also. But it narrowed the case considerably.
I thought the court said something about it even questioned the government going forward with this because of the size of it. What was that about?
I think the court, because the case took so long and there was a lot of energy from both sides involved in it, that
A lot of expense is,
the economic analysis, I think, was in his mind. Is it worth your time and trouble? And the government proceeded.
Mm-hmm. But they have to pay for their side.
Yes. And in the end, as I asked this court to do, the district court found the government substantially justified, knowing all that and with his concern, and having, as I said, lived and breathed this case, found the government substantially justified. With that, Your Honor, no further questions. I will sit down.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
1 minute and a half. Members of the court, Neither the district court didn't believe a lie was necessary for a false claims case. He basically took that out of the instruction, even though this court has said a lie must be shown. And no lie was shown in the end. There was an allegation, but our proof showed without question that there was no lie. And there was an issue of discovery, but, here's the thing. When you are required to prepare your case, you need to potentially investigate the scene of the crime. This is a forest. This is hundreds of miles of forest. We learned 2 weeks before the end of discovery the allegations of where these roads were. We submitted affidavits to show work was done on three of them. That's how much time we had. That was after the close of discovery. We submitted the worker affidavits, and the government sought to exclude those. This wasn't an eve of trial thing. Then the judge said, you can't go back out and look anymore. You can't investigate this case anymore. So we asked for a jury view, and we took videotapes. So we were either going to bring the jury out there or we're going to bring the forest to the jury. And this unequivocally showed how much work was done. The government never paid these invoices, by the way. The government sought only punitive sanctions. And in our motion for judicial notice, the rationale for all of this energy and why is in there. The government sought the removal of Marshall Pecor as forest manager, a position he's held for 30 years. He has national awards, but David Congas hated him and alleged that he was a bad actor. So in our motion for judicial notice, which is part of the 250,000 pages of documents, we give kind of an undercurrent for why the government was doing all this work. It was to basically bump up against MTE. This really had nothing to do with Marshall Pecor and Conrad Weniger. They were just floating around and happened to be the ones that signed these certifications. With respect to the contract claim, the only evidence that the government had were three photographs of the shoddy work. There are three photographs that David Congas said was evidence of the shoddy work that show, and that's in the appendix, that show three brush piles, a couple of sticks in a massive effort to open forest. That's it for the shoddy work. And if that's allowed to stand, then any time the government lends money or puts money for an Indian tribe, they can come and say, one branch is out of place, and it's shoddy work, and we're going to take you to task for false claims. That's not right. We're asking the court to do justice to these two men who basically defended the tribe as officials of the tribe and proved the government wrong. And a careful analysis of the facts proved at trial, not Chris Larson's affidavit. The government relies on what Chris Larson said, not what the evidence was. Our brief has careful analysis of what the evidence was. And when we put those requests for admissions, Your Honors, We were asking the government to admit what was in their records, that expenses were incurred that exceeded the amount that was billed, and that substantial amounts of work was done. And after 10 years, if the government can't do that, they need to seek justice. They need to seek truth, not just winning a case. And that's what I found so personally and professionally offensive here. I've never written a letter that I wrote to Chris Larson, nor to the judge, to say, look, I'm an officer of the court here. I'm not getting paid for this work. These guys can't afford me. But I couldn't let it go because what the government was doing was wrong. And it's done. These folks are out, but they have a huge legal bill to pay. And I think based on the law of this circuit, the government ought to reimburse these individuals for their expenses and attorney's fees. Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.